I haven't really woken up. Oh, until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
Hey there, animation fans, and welcome once again to the AFA podcast, the official podcast for animationforadults.com. I am Commander Rachel Ward, your host for this evening. And joining me is Dan, Ensign Dan.
Yeah, very much. Lower Decks Ensign Dan.
And a new contributor to the podcast, my very own brother. What's your rank, Michael?
I was going to make a joke. I thought you were going to call me Admiral, and I was going to say, I do not believe you have the authority from Shumaromi to the rank of Admiral. good old Prince Spiner.
Yes, indeedy. But yeah, here we are. We are here to talk about a bit of animation that came out on CBS All Access. In this country. It's called Star Trek Lower Decks. And it's going to be an interesting episode because we have some varying levels of experience with the Star Trek franchise, as it were. So, or the Star Trek series as a whole. So we'll kind of break into that right here. Michael, as far as I know, the person who knows the most Star Trek, the biggest Trekkie here, how about you break us down first?
Okay, just the overall gist of the series. This series tells the story of several ensigns on a ship called the USS Cerritos, and the focus of the series, focus being on the lower decks, that is it's billed as more the unsung heroes, the people you don't really hear about, the people who do the menial jobs on all the Star Trek series that you've ever seen. And it's been touched on before. I believe Next Gen did a episode that was focused on the same subject. Actually had the name Lower Decks as well, but this focuses on a couple of different characters of different background. The focus of the series is on a character named Bradward Boimler, Ensign Bradward Boimler, played by Jack Quaid. He's been described as someone who has read all the books, knows everything, is obsessed with Starfleet protocol because that's what he's been devoting his life to. But he's the kind of guy who would pass the written driving test with flying colors, but not know what the hell to do when he actually got behind the wheel. And his foil, Ensign Beckett Mariner, played by Tawny Newsome, is really his polar opposite. She's irreverent, she's a rule breaker, she's very good at all things Starfleet, but she doesn't want or care about promotion or ranking up, as she calls it. So she is, the dynamic that they have throughout the course of the series is Boimler is always looking for a way to brown nose, to get his way up and to move up in rank, to become a captain one day. And the way that Mariner and Boimler connect is that he shows signs of occasionally wanting to break the rules, occasionally realizing that in order to get the job done, he can't be obsessed with protocol. So that's the dynamic that they have across the course of the series. And the rest of the cast is filled out by Ensign Devana Tendi, played by Noelle Wells. She is, I'm trying to think of the right way to describe her. She is absolutely thrilled. She's just joined the Cerritos. She's absolutely thrilled to be working on a starship, but she has this kind of childlike innocence and naivete to her that is played on quite a bit throughout the show. And then of course the cast is filled out by Sam Rutherford, Ensign Sam Rutherford, played by Eugene Cordero, who is a strange take and spoof on, he's almost a spoof on Geordi LaForge from The Next Generation. but kind of taken up a notch. He is an engineering whiz. He knows everything about engines. He has these some strange cybernetic implant that allows him to adjust his personality at will. So he can be as aggressive as a Klingon one moment. He can be whining like a Ferengi the next, and really everything in between. So the overall story arc of the show is devoted around their relationship with the senior staff and their flaws complementing the senior staff's flaws and getting the job done, which is actually interesting. The job that the Cerritos is assigned is called, it's second contact, whereas ships like the Enterprise, that you'd seen in previous Star Trek series, have been focused on, seeking out new life and first contact with alien civilizations. The Cerritos' job is quote unquote second contact, that is filling out all the paperwork, setting up the infrastructure on the planet, everything that you, all the dirty jobs that the prime crew doesn't want to do, mm-hmm. is devoted to mm-hmm. The Cerritos. So
here's my question to you though, is because I think of the three of us here, you have seen the most alternate, Star Trek shows, the original series, the movies, and I mean most of this we grew up watching together, but even since then, where I've you've kind of always had a foot in this particular fandom. So how would you say this kind of holds up to other Star Trek shows?
Well, it's something that really Star Trek has never tried before. It's they've really started to take it's become a self-parody in a way. I would say it's almost a send-up, in the style of kind of Mel Brooks. That's what I would compare it to. And I was a little, hesitant about, making a judgment at first. After the first two episodes, it seemed like it was going to be just almost like a J.J. Abrams kind of pandering to the long-term fans and parody for the sake of parody, not really knowing what makes Star Trek tick. But as the show progressed, after about probably episode three or so, they really did show that they knew what Star Trek was all about building up a character's personality, finding its flaws and helping them to grow and kind of realize that you can still be an effective member of the team and an effective person despite all your flaws. And what helped me be comfortable with that is there was a story arc in The Next Generation about a character named Lieutenant Reginald Barclay, who was kind of the guy who never really fits in. He was the original Lower Decker, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. He kept to himself. He was obsessed with the holodeck. He never really fit in anywhere. But over the course of the series, the other characters help him kind of come out of his shell, mm-hmm. and be more effective as a person, be more social as a person. And I think that's what the overall, that's what the theme of the character development in the show mm-hmm. was focused on. And that was Trek tradition at its finest, despite the silliness, despite the pacing of the show, which I'll get into later. Mm-hmm. But I think for hardcore Star Trek fans, if they can really relate to anything from the original shows to this one, it's probably the development of the characters as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting to note that the brain, one of the brains behind this show, I believe last name, make sure I have the first name too, McMahon.
Yeah, Mike McMahon.
Mike McMahon.
Yeah.
Yes, who is involved with Rick and Morty, and I know I've seen a decent chunk of Rick and Morty. I know Dan, you've watched a good chunk of that too. So
I've seen all of it. Well, so Mike McMahon, yeah, he's an interesting writer. I liked his Rick and Morty episodes, but he also did a few years ago, mm-hmm. Nearly 10 years ago now, he started this this Twitter feed called TNG Season 8,
mm.
where he would just do ridiculous what if episode descriptions of imaginary season 8 episodes. So it was I'm just on the feed now and it's stuff like Troy guides a dying ensign through his final emotional journey whilst Data and Geordi are trapped in a conference room table by a scary dog. like really ridiculous, like, you know, sort of, you know, like proving like, oh, okay, like the series had really run its course by that point, and this is how bad like season 8 episodes would have been. You know, like, okay, here's another one. Wesley's nanobots are dying, filling the Enterprise with gray sand. And an hour into his wedding, Geordi realizes that his bride is a hologram.
Oh my gosh.
But it, so it's, so the thing is, like, the show is, like, written by, is created by someone who really loves Star Trek and really gets, you know, like, gets it inside out, I think. Sees it from the point of view of, like, a fan who loves it, but a fan who isn't too big to take it, you know, too seriously either.
Yes. And I think that's been, that was the overall tone of the show, was that instead of just pandering to the hardcore fans, they were respectful and made, and the references to other Trek series came fast and furious. But
yeah,
it was from that perspective. They paid homage to it, but they didn't take it too seriously. Like, for instance, there's in episode one, the ship is being attacked, and crew members are one by one becoming bloodthirsty zombies, while Rutherford and Ensign, oh crap, I can't remember her name, Ensign Barnes are on a date, and they're talking, they're having this nice little casual conversation while they're in EVA suits trying to get to the other section of the ship and, you know, solve the crisis.
And they're not really fazed by, like, what's happening.
Not at all.
I kind of like that, that for me is, like, really, so just give it, like, I don't know, like, maybe we should, like, give some context, like.
Yeah.
I'm probably, like I said, Ensign Lower Decks, the least well-versed with, like, the Trek universe. What have I done? I've seen the original series, and then, like, my uncle, when I was much younger, like, this was, like, in the early 90s, he was a really big Trek fan, and he was big into, like, TNG and Deep Space Nine, and he tried to get me into it, and I kind of, as a kid, like, rejected it. I was like, this isn't Star Wars. It's boring. Like, what is this? It's not for me. Yes.
I feel like I'm in science class, but I'm getting dumber.
Yeah, it was definitely not for me. And I sort of wrote the whole thing off, despite him, like, taking me. I remember, like, actually my uncle took me to like an exhibition that they had in London, like after TNG had wrapped, where they had like all the sets and like loads of costumes and props and things. And I must have looked like the most ungrateful little sod because I was just there like, yeah, okay, all right. And I didn't know who any of the characters were. Anyway, flash forward, one summer on TV, late at night, they showed the original series and I really got into it. Because it was kind of, I mean, like, by now, like, the original series is kind of like this artifact of '60s as well. So it's kind of, you can watch it like through a lens of like, I'm enjoying this, but also it's kind of goofy and like quite sexist at times.
It was very campy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's like campy fun there. And then I didn't really, wasn't interested in, I mean, I saw the J.J. Abrams movies and funnily enough, I think that Beyond is probably my favorite of the recent movies because it feels like a camp old original series episode.
It does, yeah.
And then, yeah, recently this year during like lockdown when I was stuck in the house with nothing to do, I sort of relented because my housemate is a massive Trekkie. And he was watching, he was watching Voyager, and I was like, maybe I want to watch Star Trek again? And he was like, okay, great, we're doing it. And like, for
down the
last,
rabbit hole we go.
From like March until, I guess, September, we were watching like 3 episodes a night, or like at least 2 episodes a night. And I fell head over heels in love with TNG.
And then, like, recently, we just finished, like, watching all the movies.
Oh, wow. Were they, like, the original movies or, like, the kind of combination of both?
Well, I had seen the original movies. I kind of liked them. They were on, like, TV on, like, Sundays. And
yeah.
I kind of, like, put them there. Like, I remember, like, seeing them, yeah, like, in that sort of context.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we watched the TNG movies, at least. And, yeah, yeah, fine. I loved First Contact. That was, like, the perfect movie for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's kind of where I am. Like, I'm pretty familiar now with TNG. You know, I don't have, like, an encyclopedic knowledge. There's a lot I've already forgotten. But my main thing, that my main takeaway, funnily enough, from TNG was that it functions like a sitcom, almost.
It does,
where
yeah.
You have, like, the core characters, and it's like The Office, you know, it's like a workplace thing, where you have the core characters, and you know who they are, so that, you know, sometimes there would be, like, a cold open, and it would be like, this is gonna happen to Data, and I'm like, I'm in. I know what that means for him, and it's, like, all about the characters, and, you know, really, like, some of my favorite episodes of TNG were the ones that were like sitcoms, where it's like Troy's mom is coming to dinner.
Oh, yes.
You know, like, it's like the, you know, for me, like, I was like, I wasn't too opposed to the whole idea of Lower Decks, because I'm like, TNG, I mean, like, Star Trek is pretty goofy. It allows itself to be goofy enough anyway. So, like, that structure's already kind of there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, I mean, just up top, I think, like, Lower Decks, for me, is actually just good Trek. Like, it's not actually... It's obviously, like, it's not overly serious, but it's not... It's actually... It functions pretty much like TNG, really. Like, that's, like, the model that it seems to really be basing itself
mm-hmm.
off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, the thing, so that's where I am with Star Trek, really, and Lower Decks.
It's a really interesting perspective that you bring, because that was actually the initial reaction to the series from a lot of hardcore Trek fans was exactly what you're talking about, the way people interacted, the people's attitudes towards each other on the show. And a lot of hardcore fans were saying, oh, they would never talk to each other like this. They have a lot more self-discipline and self-restraint in the 24th century than this. Like, this is like watching a run-of-the-mill cartoon from the 2010s. It's like they react exactly the same way. But later on, you really see, like, what, I mean, yes, it's the reason for that is because it's not for any reason other than what you said. I mean, to portray it as a sitcom where people are flawed, because I mean, you in TNG and really a lot of other Star Trek series, yeah, you saw some of the characters' flaws. I mean, how they you know, where their shortcomings were, how they reacted to one another, but it really seemed kind of artificial and kind of more for the sense of story than for really any sense of realism. So mm-hmm. now in Lower Decks, you really see, yeah, this is how human beings, I mean, yeah, maybe we're not as evolved as Gene Roddenberry thought we might be in the 24th century, but we can still treat each other well in the end. At the end of the day, we can still come to an understanding. We can still move forward and be with all the, you know, idiosyncrasies and silliness that daily life and society that comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah, that's actually, I mean, if you're talking about it like that, like, you know, it's not it's just not cynical.
No,
that in itself is quite refreshing, I think.
It is.
Yes, as well. Indeed.
But especially like you're saying, yeah, like it's a 2010s cartoon. You kind of think, well, it's Rick and Morty. It's gonna be, you know, because Rick and Morty gets to pretty almost like nihilistic places at times.
Oh yeah. Yes. I think that's part of the reasons why I would watch it and enjoy it, but there was a certain point where it's just like, this isn't, you know, like it almost became a little too nihilistic for me. which I think is what kind of pushed me away from finishing it, unfortunately. But yeah, I didn't get that. I didn't get that from this. And that's part of the reason why I'm like, okay, this is, like, again, this is coming from a guy who's clearly passionate about this. Like, I could even, I could tell that from when I was watching Rick and Morty. Like, someone clearly is a big sci-fi fan working on this, and they're just having a fun time playing with sci-fi.
It was either going to be Rick and Morty or, like, do you remember Futurama had a few great Star Trek episodes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
they did.
I felt like those writers really got that sensibility as well of, like, obviously, they were much more like original series fans, but the fact that it's just saying, like, we're going to be okay, we're going to be all right. It's okay to screw up. It's not the end of the world, because it never is. And it kind of reminds me also of, like, you know, the approach that Phil Lord and Chris Miller have.
Mm-hmm.
Where they start from a place of, like, oh my god, can you believe, like, the Lego movie? Oh my god, can you believe if we did, like, you know, like a goofy Spider-Man animated film? And then, like, actually, from starting from a place that you think is going to be parody, ends up being pretty sincere and actually, like, optimistic and, yeah, I mean, that's how I'm just repeating myself now, but, like, that's how I feel about Lower Decks. I feel like, oh, they really did the legwork of, like, figuring out the dynamics of what a crew would be like. And also, it's not straight ahead exactly how Star Trek functions, because it's the, what's it called, the Cerrito?
Doritos.
Yeah, Cerritos.
Cerritos. And it's like, it's like the second fiddle to the Enterprise. And the whole ship is of the feeling of, like, oh, we're not the Enterprise, of course. Like,
yeah. So mm-hmm. It's probably, I think it's even like the third or fourth or fifth fiddle from a hierarchy standpoint, because they're going to planets that have already had first contact, and they're doing all the menial grunt work that no one else wants to do. So
there are a few great shots where they literally demonstrate that by having them next to a higher ranking ship.
And it's
they'll be completely eclipsed.
Or even in just, like, the opening sequence, like the one of the things that I always remember, what I would remember when we were kids watching Star Trek The Next Generation, would be that kind of, like, open, a cold open is what we called it, where it's just kind of like the shots of the ship flying through space. And, you know, well, it was, you know, I remember it felt so grand and so huge in Next Generation and Voyager and all those shows that we watched together. But then you have this show, which basically takes the same idea, and it has, like, everything that could go wrong does for that ship. Like, it's
to your point, I believe there's one scene in that in the opening sequence where there's a bunch of Romulans battling the Borg, and there's all these laser beams flying everywhere, and there's so much chaos. The Cerritos shows up, takes one look at it, and is like, you know what? Never mind.
It's like, nope, it nopes right out of that. Right, right now.
It's good to know your limits, I suppose.
Yes.
So like, that was, you know, like, you guys, like, you were saying, like, sort of basically grew up watching Star Trek together, right?
Yeah, yeah. TNG to start, and then we over time discovered, like, I followed TNG through DS9 through Voyager, and then interspersed in the middle there, went back and discovered the original series.
Yeah, we had some of them, like, while we were watching, like, The Next Generation on television, like, we would, like, gather as a family, and we would watch it together in the evenings.
Yeah.
And then we would have, like, I think we had a couple VHS tapes of, like, the original movies with, you know, Kirk and Spock and all them.
Yeah, it was easy to watch Next Generation. I think that's one of the reasons that Next Gen became so popular, was because it was released on what was called first run syndication here in the States, where any television station anywhere, regardless of what network they're affiliated with, can play it in prime time. So there were no restrictions about when, there weren't as many restrictions about when it could be shown, how many times it could be shown. So
It
saturated the market and people ended up watching it because they had nothing better to do, and hence the popularity.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's cool. So it could be like on like Tuesday night on one channel, and then like, you know, the next evening it could be on another channel.
Depends on what area you're in. I mean, it could be on, for instance, it could be on CBS on one night, and then kind of a smaller local station, perhaps. A different time on another night, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Right. So it was very widespread in terms of having airtime on TV. So it's like, and even now, like, we'll still run into like episodes playing during the day. Like what I forget what channel plays.
BBC America is running them over and over and over again during the day. Right. That's funny. Actually at work, I see some of my, it's on a lot of the TVs and on where I work, just happens to be during the day because they like BBC America where I work apparently or something.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
It's a good channel.
It's my first watch of TNG was this year. Like, the crazy thing for me was just how almost like old fashioned it feels now.
Oh yes.
compared to, and that was actually like what was so refreshing for me about it was the fact that, you know, like 2 minutes can happen and nothing's really changed, and the pacing was like, you know, I've heard lots of people say that recently about TNG, like the pacing is glacial compared to a lot of TV nowadays. I don't know if I completely agree, because there were definitely some episodes where it felt like they ran out of time and they would just like, they would cut from like someone stuck in a Jefferies tube to like, Captain's log, everything turned out fine, you know, like, we've got to wrap it up.
There were budgetary limitations. Even back then, like the cast repeatedly says they made the show on technically a shoestring. So even then, I mean, there was more money in the 80s and 90s than there was in the 60s, sure, but there were budgetary limitations. And I think the other thing too is that the pace feels so slow at times, because what Star Trek does very well is write, you know, very good character-driven morality plays. That's kind of been its bread and butter that, appeal to some people, but not others, especially people who grew up with Star Wars, expecting that fast-paced world of battle that really isn't always there in Star Trek.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who compare Star Wars to Star Trek, and I will admit, of the two, I'm probably more of a fan of Star Wars, but that's just because I'm a very big into the whole, you know, sci-fi fantasy aspects and tropes that they play with in that particular universe. But this is definitely, I like the fact that this is, Star Trek had those really detailed character-driven stories. And that's what's led, I think, to an interest in those kind of narratives in other forms of, in other franchises and other forms of media. So because it just had this, yeah.
Star Trek also, like, I think just has like more imagination. Actually, like, the universe feels so much bigger in Star Trek compared to Star Wars, where it's like,
we'll hop
from this sand planet to that, like, you know, slightly more built up planet, and then there's a forest planet or something, and it's like everything feels sort of in the same galaxy, really, whereas like Star Trek feels so much more vast.
Oh yes, there's a lot more to the galaxy. It's multiple galaxies.
And I think some of that has to do with the lore too, because in Star Wars, I mean, with the technology of hyperspace available, I mean, they haven't explored the entire galaxy, but it seems like they have most of it pretty well mapped out, and you can get from one end to the other. Knowing more or less what you're going to find. Whereas in Trek, they're only the Federation and it's the species that you know are cordoned off in about a little sector that's about 11% of the galaxy, when in fact there's all this other space that no one's ever seen and no one's ever charted yet. I mean with the exception of Voyager, then they've seen the far reaches of the galaxy and Deep Space Nine as well, But even with all that they show you in those two series, there's still a ton of the galaxy that's been left unexplored. So you really don't know what you're going to get from a Star Trek episode.
I remember this happening this year where I was watching it with my housemate who has seen like everything, Voyager and Enterprise. Like he was, we were watching it and I was like sort of discovering it as I go. And I was saying to him like, look, I'm going to be like your grandma watching this. I am going to have questions that are going to seem really irritating. So like sometimes there would be something like, you know, like, oh, we're going past like Federation space, and I'm like, but they're in space. And then he had to like pause, he would like pause it and then sit down and be like, okay, how do I explain this? And my frustration was always like, why doesn't the show just like tell me this stuff? Why do you have to be my personal wiki for this? And he was like, okay, that's a good point actually. And you know, as much as you know, I've seen people say that TNG is like slower paced nowadays, it chucks a lot at you, and there's a lot to sort of like keep juggling. But anyway, so we should be talking about Lower Decks really. I think
it kind of ties into it though, because a lot of what you see in the first season is very heavily based on what TNG did, and a lot of like like from the references to the jokes, like a lot of it was based on that kind of like playing it safe with the more, I guess, well-known version of show of
what I liked about
Next Generation.
I think I would probably say that you probably would have a hard time enjoying this if you didn't know from Star Trek.
I wouldn't, maybe not quite that far, but I would say like the I'd say a good maybe a quarter of the humor would be lost on you if you hadn't been familiar with it, because they go some of the references go actually really deep. Like for instance, there's one episode where Boimler and Mariner are arguing about whether Roga Daynar was badass or not, and you only meet Roga Daynar for about 20 well maybe about half hour 45 minutes in one episode of Next Gen. And I he is kind of badass, but he's never seen or spoken of again. So it's really hard to know who he is if you haven't seen the episode The Hunted from season 3 of Next Gen.
And they talk about Khan too, who was a, you know, the from all the memes of Shatner screaming Khan.
He's a little more recognizable.
Yeah.
But primary antagonist. Another example would be there's a statue that they revere Miles O'Brien, and there's a statue dedicated to him in one episode. And, you know, if you haven't, you probably know who he is if you have watched a little bit of Next Gen, but if you haven't seen Deep Space Nine, you really don't know what he's gone through and why he's so revered. So I'd say probably maybe it's about a quarter to a third of the humor might be lost on somebody.
Well, that was funny to me because I haven't seen Deep Space Nine. So to me, like there being a statue to Miles O'Brien is like, what, the guy who ran the transporter? That's not okay, sure, why not?
It works on a couple of different levels then, but the thing that really I respected about the way that they brought in some of that Trek lore from way deep in the Memory Alpha wiki is how kind of evenly spaced it was. It seemed like everything got equal irreverence dedicated towards it. Like there's one episode where Rutherford says they're making like a movie within a show about kind of a spoof of The Wrath of Khan. And he talks about transporters. He's like, it's a movie. We can do whatever we want with transporters.
I wrote that down. I love that line. That was great.
In the first JJ movie from 2009, Scotty, they talk about transport beam, I was the one who invented transport beaming. I can beam something from one planet to another, which is really easy, by the way. It's like, you've never done that before ever in any show or movie. Like, what are you talking about?
Well, so this is like obviously the problem that a lot of fans have with those movies is that they're made by people who don't actually really love Star Trek.
Yeah, they say they do, but they're just don't.
You know, like as someone who I was never that into Star Trek, I still think that's pretty rude. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Right. It is. It
but, absolutely. But you know, like this really does feel like someone who loves Star Trek, and it feels like it's not there are very few like cheap jokes
that yeah.
that don't really hold up. So like if, for instance, something is introduced and it feels like, haha, that's a funny joke, like, oh, you know, like you know, the pack lids are here. Like,
yes.
everything that and we'll get to them, but like everything that has been set up about them is like baggage that the show kind of has to deal with. So it doesn't write off like the logic of things. It's like, okay, the Packlets are here. Well, what are they known for? You know, they're known for like being morons, but also like, you know, only having parts of other ships. And yeah, no, I loved the way that it did that. That's what I mean when I say like, it's actually like proper Star Trek for me, because
yeah.
it does follow the logic of how each race kind of fits in and how they function and their culture and things like this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's in the pack, it's interesting you mentioned them, because it works on two separate levels with them, because there's parodying them and parodying the way they were personified in Next Gen, but they're also in a way giving them a chance to shine by making them a legitimate threat, yes. probably even more so yeah. than in Next Gen, which is
that was impressive. It was
great for them. I mean, it's
I hated the packlet so much.
Yeah, and yeah, even in Next Gen,
I had like a, you know, like usually when you're watching like, you know, something, you're like, oh, I hate this character. They're so
mm-hmm.
and you kind of enjoy hating them, like Q or something.
Yeah. Oh yes.
I actually hated them. So I was just like, they're idiots and they're mean. Like, that's like the worst combination.
Oh yes.
And the voice actor yeah. of Starscream from Transformers had the unfortunate task to play the lead Packled back in Next Gen.
Are we talking about
Chris? Aren't stupid.
Are we talking about Chris Latta?
Yes, we are talking about Chris.
Oh my Latta. God, I love him.
I did not know that fact. That's amazing. Yay.
They were struggling. Yeah. I mean, you did, being a voice actor didn't pay the bills back in the 80s. So
no, yeah.
For guest spots on shows like that all the
time. Yeah, is that Bryan Cranston? I think he had played a part as a Power Ranger monster.
He did.
A long time ago.
Yeah. But I put a question to you two
uh-huh.
with your experience. I don't have as much experience with Rick and Morty as you two. The one thing, if there were anything about this series that I won't say I disliked it per se, but it kind of rubbed me a little the wrong way. The pacing in this show is lightning fast. The jokes come at you just rapid fire, episode after episode. And I think to some degree you get used to it, but to another degree, I feel like someone maybe coming into this from outside might not like that either. What did you guys think of that?
I mean, it definitely was fast paced. And that was something I did another, like us, you know, aside from the animation style that you see in, Rick and Morty is kind of similar, not the definitely I'd say a bit more fine in terms of the style and design, definitely has its own unique look, but in terms of the pace, yeah, the pacing was for sure Rick and Morty has a similar level of like kind of fast-paced humor. Like I don't think there's ever, unless there's an episode that I haven't seen where you can correct me, Dan, but most of the episodes in terms of its humor or just like kind of big moments, like they come pretty fast. Like I don't think there's ever been a moment where the show really slows down in terms of delivering its jokes and its humor.
No, I think that's like, I mean, that's like a modern animation thing where like,
yeah,
it's almost like a challenge. How much can we pack in?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And in truth, I mean, like there's, you know, the stories that are told in Lower Decks are sort of, you know, it's like 23 minutes, I think, each episode.
Yeah, 22, roughly, yeah. I believe, yeah.
Roughly around there, yeah.
And they're telling, you know, they're actually telling the kinds of stories that you would get on TNG in like 45 minutes.
Yes.
And they're not really backing down from that. Like there's, you know, the setup is the same, more or less, and you have the setup and then you have like, you know, them going to a planet usually or something like that, setting off, and then there's a turn, and then there's like, you know, and this, you know, the thing that I like about it as well is the action is pretty good.
I think
something that is appealing about it is that there are things happening in the show that you would only ever happen, you know, that would only really ever happen in movies because of, you know, the scope is actually pretty huge. Like, you know, in quite a few episodes, like the ship is like torn apart.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
You know, there is really big, like, action set pieces, you know, that would be like, you know, like season finales of like something like TNG or Voyager. It's like really, it delivers on that front. And that for me is why it's not like, you know, it could have been a really like shitty, like Spaceballs style parody, yes, where it's like, look how goofy it is. But it's not doing that at all. It's saying, I think it's saying that Star Trek's awesome, but you know, it's kind of funny how a lot of the characters like survive, basically.
Because
I think for me, like, that was always the joke with, you mentioned Mike, Barkley. The joke for me was always like, how the hell did he ever get that far?
Exactly.
How did he get on the Enterprise?
Well, but you see over the course of the time that he's a genius. He knows what he's doing. It's just that his social phobias and kind of inability to relate to other people on that level, on a personal level, is what's getting in his way. But as that's something that can be overcome.
And that's what's great about like about Lower Decks as well, is that it understands that, like I was saying before, you know, it's like, it's kind of a workplace sitcom. Mm-hmm. There's as much time spent in the, you know, in original Star Trek and in like Lower Decks in the bar as there is anywhere else. And, you know, like, I mean, you know, no one has their own quarters. They have these weird, they sleep in the corridors.
Yeah, they had a weird, the fans didn't react to that well for some of them didn't at first, but then.
Oh, really?
Even in Next Generation, in the episode Lower Decks, you see that the junior officers, you have to rank up to get your own quarters. That's the way it is in most navies in the world. When you're when you're an enlisted person or a junior officer, you don't get your own quarters. You have to sleep with everybody else in the berthing areas. So sorry, back to your point.
No, exactly. That stuff I think is, I don't know, like just another reason why I like it, because it's a very loving parody that really does its. It's homework.
Mm-hmm.
But this is really good
world building too.
Yeah. So what makes this one different is the fact that, I guess, so like Mike, you could probably help us with this one.
Sure.
We're following Beckett Mariner. She's ostensibly the main character, right?
Yeah.
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 Played by Tawny Newsome, and who is like amazing. I think she's like,
really good up and coming. I won't say comic actress yet, but she can do that very well, as she's proved.
Yeah, and the character herself goes through a really great arc.
I feel like I've listened to her like quite a few times on she's on Harmon Quest, and but she's been in lots of improv podcasts that I end up listening to.
Okay.
And she really has that kind of style of delivery where it feels I think this is actually probably where I think the Rick and Morty influence is probably biggest, in the fact that there's, you know, they're clearly asking them to like ad lib and kind of really go for a really natural kind of performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where, her like, first lines are a good example of that, when she shows up to Boimler in the closet, drunk, just completely drunk, and swinging a Klingon batleth around at him. Yeah. I think that illustrates your point very, very well. It seems like they just letting her kind of go off the script and do what she does really added to what her character was all about.
And we find out at the end of, I guess we should also mention, like, spoilers.
We're
kind of assuming that you've seen the first season. I'm pretty sure the second one's on the way, right?
Yeah, they from what I read an interview with Mike McMahon, and he was talking about how they pretty much got everything for the second season all set and ready to go, in terms of they just need to, you know, get it. I think they're just going through production. Basically, he's, from what I understand, he's looking to explore, like, well, the, you know, Next Generation was like the primary inspiration, and like, oh, they based a lot of the jokes and references off the Next Generation for the first season. They are planning on exploring stuff like, you know, Deep Space Nine and that kind of what that brought to Star Trek.
You know, I could never, so I obviously, like, after marathoning TNG, I got to Deep Space Nine and I didn't like it. I was like, what is this? This is
a different type of show.
This you and me are the same mind, Dan. I had
I was watching TNG and it was like the perfect show for this year for me, where it's like, it's essentially optimistic. Like, it's optimistic about the future, about people, about, and it's kind of bright, and the hallways are all, you know, pristine and lovely, and, you know, like the whole joke of the, you know, the bridge is that it's kind of designed to look like a 90s like sports car, you know, with the interior.
Less, yeah.
But, you know, like, I got to Deep Space Nine, I was like, this is a bummer. Like, seriously, this, everyone's like at each other's throats, and it's like, and I just sort of rejected it on those terms because it just came across as really drab.
And some things could be kind of repetitive when you thought about it. Like, it seemed like Odo makes a reference every episode. I'm watching your every move, Quark, so don't think you can get away with any lawbreakers.
Well, yeah, I'll admit, I only saw about like 8 episodes before I was just like, this is the sort of part of 90s sci-fi that I would rather not deal with right now.
Like, yeah,
you know, the sort of harsh industrial sort of, you know, feeling of it. And anyway, so what I was trying to say, yeah, I was trying to get to, you know, before I went off on like 18 tangents, was that,
like,
Mariner,
we've never done that before. Mariner
is kind of the main character for me.
Yeah.
And the thing that's set up at this, in the first episode, really, at the end, is that Freeman is
the captain.
The captain. And it's also her mum.
Right, which we find out that episode, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really interesting setup. Like, it definitely made me want to see the next one and see where it was headed.
Mm-hmm.
Because and the fact that also they wanted to keep it a secret. And that's a thing that I don't know if I've seen before in Star Trek, but maybe,
there goes our camera.
Maybe that dynamic before in Star Trek.
Yeah, well, I was actually going to say that is in itself, I think they were trying to take the whole, because as you remember in Next Generation, Wesley Crusher, who was, I mean, technically sort of, was not technically an officer, but he still served on the ship with his mother, which apparently everyone was completely okay with and had no problem, like, about, like, the word nepotism never came up. But as we see in Lower Decks, it's just exactly those reasons that Captain Freeman, being the protocol driven officer that she is, and wanting to, you know, run her ship and, you know, build a reputation for herself on her own merit, doesn't want to be known that Beckett is her daughter, not just because she's a screw up, but because of being, even the suggestion of there being a way to curry favor for Beckett to move up through the ranks because of her mother's status and her father's status for that matter. Her father's an admiral. I think the way that they played that was a lot more realistic, and they kind of, it tied up some of the loose ends that were left in Next Generation on that subject. I thought that was really clever the way that they did that and the way they developed that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was interesting. And it's also like the story of the first season, really. Like, that's
more
the arc is, you know, like, who's going to find out, and is that going to jeopardize like missions or anything really.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what's Beckett's motivation as well? I mean, from her, because she, yeah. I think she resents the fact that Freeman is her mom as much as the other way around. And the struggle for Beckett is that she wants to maintain this cool image that she has of, you know, not caring about protocol, just getting the job done on her own terms. But the harder thing for her to do, the real challenge for her is to follow the rules. And so she's caught in this catch-22 where she wants to take on the challenges that are presented to her, but the one challenge that she has to face is the one that she doesn't want to face.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets up a very interesting kind of dilemma for her that she kind of comes and goes throughout the entire series. And then the fact that Boimler to her represents that challenge because he is so just comedically obsessed with following protocol and sticking his nose up his superior's asses to get
because he thinks like if he can, yeah, he would kill to be in her position.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah,
and he tries so hard to get everything that comes automatically to her, which mm-hmm. is a great dynamic. I think that dynamic works so well because
mm-hmm.
it's the classic odd couple dynamic. Yeah, the one who's completely uptight and maybe a little naive, and the one who is just the exact polar opposite. That was interesting. You picked out Boimler because I think the way they deceive you a little bit, or at least I was deceived by that dynamic at first, because it seemed like they were building up Boimler to be the classic, you know, avatar of the fans, the one who, you know, wants to be involved, the wants to, you know, go through the ranks and follow Starfleet to the letter, because, you know, he's built it up in his mind to be this great thing. And Tendi does this to a certain degree, but
mm-hmm.
Boimler wants to do that. But as the series progresses, you find that he's just so like unbelievably devoted to protocol and ranking up and following and, you know, brown nosing to his superiors that he's not quite the person that you thought he was.
Yeah, he's not really the audience surrogate at first glance.
It's over. It ends up being he's so over the top that you kind of relate more to Beckett than to him ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it reminds me of like the arc for me of TNG of like, and the first season like kind of like deals with it to death, but the whole idea of how often do we actually follow the Prime Directive? And there's a great joke, I think, in the last episode where Freeman actually says something like, oh God, the Federation's policy of some interference is
yes
annoying. And I'm like, thank you for actually like acknowledging the fact that most stories of TNG, most Prime Directive stories are about sometimes, you know, if we're striving for this,
utopian, you know, society
to be these like paragons of like fairness and morality, then actually sometimes we often need to break the rules to do the right thing. And I liked how they carried that through into Lower Decks. So mm-hmm. Maybe we can't really talk about every episode.
But no.
I think we can definitely talk about like highlights and ideas that I guess really, really worked.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta say, I think I enjoyed the first episode a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun. It was fun as like just a normal, like a pilot of just like, does this thing even work?
Yeah. And does this show have legs?
And as such, like the actual, you know, the actual sci-fi element of like the zombies was fine, pretty straightforward, not too like I don't know, like interesting. I think the third episode for me is when I started to go like, oh, this is really playing with things with the idea of getting rid of buffer time, because that for me was when it was just like, okay, Star Trek is basically a workplace comedy, so basically we got to go through with that, and we've got to, you know, everyone's meant to be working the whole time, and they play with the joke of like, well, we don't actually work all the time,
Yeah, and that's and see
no,
that
I
ties
like that in, idea.
That yeah. that even ties into what Scotty used to say sometimes in either in the movies or in the original series. He's like, an engineer is at least a little conservative, at least a bit on paper. And then Kirk's like, Mr. Scott, have you always multiplied your repair times by a factor of four? And it's like, yeah. So they don't work all the time.
Yeah. 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 That for me was when the series started going like, I don't know, sort of like proving itself to be, I don't know, just when it kicked off properly. Like, was there a moment for you two when you sort of went, you sat up and you were like, oh, okay, this is,
I think
it did take a little while.
It does take a little while. I was actually really impressed with the show that let me make sure I remember the name. It was one of the later ones. Was it Crisis Point? Yeah, I think it was Crisis Point. Like, it was, I was really surprised by that episode.
Oh, that was the movie one.
That was the movie. Oh my god, because I loved the Star
that
Trek
was
movies.
So, funny.
So
yeah.
I loved how they just mm-hmm. really went like balls to the wall, like having all of these like elements that you've seen in like some of the Star Trek movies, but really connecting it to that like the stuff that we've been building up through the whole show, which is that tension between Mariner and her mother, and then how she views her mother, and then just getting a more or less a very very violent therapy session for herself in terms of how
well, that for me is the yeah and like funnily enough like I mean like I don't want to be unfair with drawing this comparison, but mm-hmm. that for me is the most Rick and Morty episode as well.
Yeah, where, I was wondering
basically,
about that as we were watching it,
where basically it starts off with an idea and then it just pings itself off into somewhere completely unrelated, and you're like, what does this have to do with anything? I mean, it's fun. And then you realize that actually it's like a circle, like it's coming back round to mm-hmm. the fact that, you know, she was avoiding going to therapy the whole time, but in fact inadvertently made like the perfect therapy session where she actually like literally fights herself.
I love that twist in that episode, because as that violence, and she's really getting more and more into this like the violent side of herself, the part that hates Starfleet, and she's like, and even to the point where some of her own, like, you know, the other characters are kind of bailing on her in a way, because like especially like Tendi, like, I love the scene between her and Tendi where Tendi's like, okay, no, you have this is some bad stuff, I'm not this is not fun for me anymore, I'm leaving. But then of course, you know, she's beating up on the hologram version of her mother and really kind of going into like this like darker side of herself. And then here comes hologram version of her. And then they literally duke it out, and with her own hologram basically sacrificing herself for the rest of the crew. It's like, you talk all this bullshit that you hate Starfleet, you really don't.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also like, it's probably also possibly the most like spoofy episode as well, because it really skewers like a lot of Star Trek movie all the stuff about the new reveal of the ship like being so over the top.
Crying
when they see the new ship.
That was a send up of the original 1979 motion picture, because there is a good probably third of that movie that's devoted to just the exterior space shots, and it moves so slow. I'm still a fan of that movie personally. I like it for what it is, but I can see why other
that
people don't like it.
That's the first one I saw as well. And it was just like, it was not, it wasn't exciting for like.
They call it Star Trek the Motionless Picture for a reason.
Just cut the goddamn shot already.
That's so mean. That's so mean. Hey, that movie gave us the main TNG theme.
I mean, yes. That's true. Yeah, yes, you are absolutely correct there.
So, I mean, I guess, like, that's episode 9? Like, that's pretty deep in. Were there moments, like, before when it was
the series? That's the first one that jumped into me. I think maybe it's because we watched those episodes just yesterday for this recording that stood out most in my mind as well.
Yeah, for me, the turning is see episode 3, the Boimler effect was what was a turning point for me, but I also like the episode that the other real turning point for me, where I really started to grasp that, okay, this is real, this is actually really good Trek. I mean, it's portraying it, it's spoofing it, but it's portraying it lovingly, was that episode 4, Moist Vessel, where you have the two kind of dueling plots going on, where you Freeman realizes that the best way to take care of Mariner is to give her the thing she wants the least, and that is a promotion. And she's promoted to lieutenant, and she's dealing with that, while at the same time, the ship is basically terraforming itself. And Tendi is trying to deal with that, while at the same time, you know, help this other crewman with his ascension or whatever. And
the ascension was so funny.
That was the great thing about it. It's funny, but it's still Trek. It's still that's the kind of plot that you would see portrayed in, say, a Next Generation a little bit more seriously. But it is that to a degree, but it fits with the theme and the tone of the show at the same time. I thought that was very, very clever how they handled all those plots came out still feeling like Star Trek. I think that was really the point that started, really kind of cemented in my mind, okay, this is good Star Trek. I'm gonna keep watching this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's I like to see this about a lot of shows sometimes. Well, this is especially true for like this large amount of like Japanese animation that's out there and Japanese animated shows. Like sometimes you have to wait till like 3 to 4 episodes in before a show can really start to get going, because then you can kind of really hit the feet. Because I know Avatar the Last Airbender was the same for me, where like you had the first 2 episodes, which were like basically a long pilot. And then you get to the 3rd episode where you find out like, okay, this show's not just going to be about the main protagonist and his little small crew. It's also, we're going to be going back and seeing what our antagonistic forces are. It's like you have Aang and Zuko are both, you're seeing both their sides of the story. So it's like, but we only had to wait to get to the 3rd episode to see that narrative take shape. And then, so you kind of got a similar way with this show. You get to see how those different character stories start to take shape.
That's the mark of a great show, is to, no matter what affiliation they have, if a show makes you care about literally everyone and what happens to them, then you've got something special.
Yeah, absolutely. What was the next one after that? Oh, it was Cupid's Errant Arrow.
That was when
Boimler had a girlfriend and like... Mariner was completely convinced that she can't be real, that she's like got a parasite or something.
That was like a Geordi episode, but I think that made me wonder about, I mean, because I don't think they were doing any kind of any hints at shipping between Boimler and Mariner. I don't think there was any jealousy involved there, but it seems like they're just trying to portray the darker and more flawed side of Mariner's personas. Like she is trying to be Boimler's friend, but she at the same time she thinks so little of him as a person that how could he possibly be happy in having, you know, luck and romance with the kind of person that he is. And it kind of keeps you from really, for her, from like endearing to me all the way. I mean, there are a lot of things about her personality that I like, but she can be so arrogant in that way at the same time that, like...
Well, she's a deeply flawed character. Well, sure. As if the 9th episode pointed out, like, when we talked about earlier. But
the truth is, like, I don't think there's been a character like her before, because she would usually be disciplined much more harshly for, like, insubordinate behavior.
Yeah.
She gets away with a lot. And I think we got to talk about like the spoiler, the fact that by the end of the series, like everyone finds out about her relationship with the captain and everything. And it's like, that bubble was going to burst at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that they've changed that, because actually, like, again, that's something that TNG introduced, like the whole of TV, was the fact that characters could evolve and, you know, like change,
over the course of like, you know, seasons. So I like that that's already shifted, because now she's going to have to, for herself, like, you know, shave off those rougher edges of like her own like behavior, really.
Yes. But yeah, now that spoiler alert again, I think now that she knows toward the end of the episode that she has, like, I think because Freeman has the line right at the end that I think you'd do better having a captain at your side rather than up your ass.
Mm-hmm. I like that line.
And that'll be easier for her to do now because she feels like she has a supporter. She doesn't feel like it's just her against the rest of the ship anymore.
Mm-hmm. And I love how, if everybody mentioned this, like the best, like the way they ended that last episode with, you know, he Boimler got that promotion he's been wanting so much
to Commander Riker, or Captain Riker's ship, no less.
That was a great for that season finale. That was a fantastic reveal or twist at the end of that episode when we had those characters show up.
Yeah.
It's like, who do you think I've been getting all my contraband from? And Riker's like,
no, that was awesome. I like the one where the where Boimler got caught in the transport and he sort of
kept,
we're talking episode 7, Much Ado About Boimler.
Yes.
He kept on Much Ado About, yeah, where he kept on like beaming and it was making that horrible whining noise. I love that because that for me again was like a great like sitcom level setup of like, okay, you know, he wants to impress, you know, like the boss who's coming to dinner kind of thing. What's the worst thing that could happen? Oh, he looks like a, you know, and I liked all that stuff where he was pretending that everything was fine and they were like, go to sick bay, and he's like, but that's for sick people. I enjoyed that one a lot.
And that was a good side plot, or like, is there's that plot, and there's also the other plot in that episode where you have Mariner hanging out with an old academy buddy who's a captain now, and it's like, okay, why don't you assert yourself? And she's doing all the usual fuck up stuff, and it's just okay, this was a way to look at her, like a good insight into her character. It's like, okay, you are really good at being, you know, you could be a captain if you really asserted yourself, but the thing is that she's not asserting herself for whatever reason. We find out why.
Yeah.
Well, it's also like, it's not that she's not asserting herself, it's that like, you know, this was sort of Riker's conflict in like halfway through TNG again, of like, look, you should be a captain of your own ship. Why are you holding yourself back?
Because as we find out in that episode, she's when the chips aren't down, she's not being forced to make the quick decisions. She keeps screwing up and deliberately, because she doesn't want to be seen as this competent officer. She wants to stay where she is because it's the easier for her to do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it gives her license to keep screwing up when she needs to. And she's terrified of the idea of being under any kind of microscope. From anyone. No, that stuff was fun. And I kind of liked the whole, you know, the thing is that it is also like a funny show. So like the whole idea of the farm was great, because
now that's something that, I mean, in that episode it kind of works, but in the very next episode, Veritas, and we'll talk about both at the same time, I think that they sometimes miss the mark a little bit as far as kind of that comedic twist at the end. The farm they could get away with, they got away with introducing kind of the people that you don't hear about, the people who never recover from the horrible transporter accident. And they try to build it up as this kind of adversarial thing, when then completely deflate it by realizing, oh yeah, we were going to the farm all the time. They do
and it
that.
Actually was a paradise.
It kind of works there, but in the next episode, Veritas, when they're put on trial, quote unquote, to find out that towards the end, it's a party. Like
that
seems it seems like it's very uneven how they set those things up.
I think that's an okay like thing to do in 10 minutes, but because each it was 20 minutes and you spent a long time with like each cat. I quite enjoy, you know, the thing is though, like even as the episode was going on, I was like, well, clearly they should be speaking to sorry, what's her name? I'm not good with the characters' names.
That's okay.
They should be speaking to, what's her name? She's blue.
Who?
Tendi.
Tendi, oh yeah, because she clearly knows more than she lets
clearly
on.
Clearly something's up
time.
With Tendi. But then like, we have like quite a nice, like funny like backstory with, what's his name?
With Rutherford.
Oh God, with his.
With Rutherford, yeah. That was funny, but I knew watching it, I was like, this isn't going to have anything to do with anything.
Mm-hmm.
It pads out the episode nicely, though.
Yeah, it did. But then, the last two episodes were just, I pretty much watched them immediately after one another because of, like, the big high concept idea of, I mean, it's very Rick and Morty as well, like, the whole idea of, like, jumping inside a movie and it having fun with all of the you know, with the parody stuff, but also being a very good parody, a very good like character study episode as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that's, I'm pretty sure it's Paul F. Tompkins who's the therapist. He was really funny. I loved him.
Mm-hmm.
He kept on making like food metaphors.
Yes, that was the reason why they didn't want to go see him, or Marinette didn't want to see him. And then you find out later in the episode when she's kind of worked through her sessions, like, and kind of passes her mom in the hallway. And her mom's like, I know she's up to something, and she's going to see the same. You find she's going to see the exact same therapist.
Captain Carol, you're being quite the pineapple here.
yeah. No, that was great. I love that. And then yeah, the finale is like great too. I watched it like a few hours ago, but I can't even remember what happened. Oh, the peanut hamper. Like that
was
peanut
hamper.
That's a very deep reference in itself, because the Exocomps were in one episode of Next Generation. It was a good episode, but
yes, I remember this one.
They were never seen or heard of again.
Yes, they were. It was the whole idea of the episode, wasn't it? Was they had to send like this. I mean, it was just like a little like service robot, really, wasn't it? Like down a tube, but it opened up this whole moral debate of like consent and like slavery.
Yeah, are these
almost?
Yeah, are these things alive? Are they sentient? Are we making them slave labor? And should we send them on suicide missions because of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the main plot of that episode, like, because you have that, that's like the third part of the plot is with Peanut Hamper. But the first part is, of course, from the last episode, Boimler learning about the secret between Mariner and her mom, mm-hmm. the captain. Mm-hmm.
I like that he finds it out. By kind of snooping and kind of doing the wrong thing, but also like it's not that hard for him to find out either.
No,
it's just like circumstance. It's not exactly, it's not because you forget by the time that it happens, you forget the fact that he really wasn't supposed to use the, there's a quick line about like, you're not supposed to be using our personal logs for that, you know.
Is that drawing? Yeah, but but he's Boimler is Mr. the classic in the wrong place at the wrong time, constantly kind of character. So I think a lot of what happens to him throughout the series is based on circumstance rather than, you know, whether what he does or does not do.
Because he's the reluctant hero. The whole thing, the whole thing is that, like, he wants to be, like, this perfect, you know, Starfleet
officer,
but he can't deal with most of what officers deal with, which is the unexpected things.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, having to think on the fly and,
and
improvising and playing, you know, fast and loose with the rules. And every time he's chucked in that, you know, like, he's tested that way. But I'm interested now, like, thinking about that stuff, like how the characters are going to change in the next season.
Especially with the not being on the same ship anymore.
Something, I don't know, I feel like they'll tie that up pretty quickly. Like, something's going to happen where either they, like, somehow through some strange comedic twist of fate, Boimler ends up back on the Cerritos somehow, or there's some kind of dueling plot with the time. I mean, I think they will, because I don't think they intended John Frakes or Marina Sirtis to be regular members of the cast. So that was just a treat.
I can't imagine
that was a treat for the finale, most likely. So he'll wind up on the Cerritos or with the main cast somehow.
Yeah, whether it's on the Cerritos or whether they're gonna change setting next season, or I'm sure they're gonna find a way to keep the cast together, like, through some kind of happenstance, because that's just what's, like you said, that character is always at the wrong place at the wrong time.
There you go. That one episode, I think it was episode 4, the way they went back to status quo was Beckett was called out an admiral for pronouncing the word sensor wrong. Like, you see. Which was a joke, because which was a joke throughout the TNG lore, that they had different characters to pronounce it differently. Sensors.
This is a very wacky show, but I love it.
No, I'm keen to rewatch it, because I know that there's a lot that I missed. Because you said, like, and I think that's also, Mike, I think that's also the part of the philosophy behind, like, you know, like the Rick and Morty's, you know, breakneck pacing is, yes, like, you will miss jokes and you will get them on, like, the fourth viewing, or you'll miss, like, one little side comment that, you know, will
or even some background, something that's way off in the background that you notice later, and it's like, oh, I remember that from Next Gen, or et cetera, et cetera.
I know that there are loads of, like, blink and you'll miss it, you know.
Easter eggs and such.
Gags. Yeah, I'm sure there's stuff in the background that I've definitely missed. Did you guys have any, like, last thoughts about, like, I don't know, like, Star Trek in general, because actually Star Trek in general, right, as I was saying, the I really love TNG, but I've been told that Voyager comes close to that kind of flavor.
Yes. I would wholeheartedly agree that
it would,
at least in my opinion.
I would argue that yes, in a way, in a sense that you don't know what you're going to get from week to week, because they're going through a region of space that hasn't been seen a whole heck of a lot.
Right.
So in that sense, that was what they were billing it as, but I think it turned into its own beast very quickly. And in the sense that the character dynamic was much different. It was a lot darker, a lot more Deep Space Nine than the original series was. But I think overall, just to get back to your question, Star Trek in general is kind of going through a renaissance right now, because we've had more Star Trek content come out within the last 12 months than we have ever, because we've had Star Discovery, which is now in season 3 and getting and building up its own kind of following, steadily. And then we have Star Trek Picard, which was a very good show. And now the Lower Decks. And I think there's at least two or three other series, some animated, some live action, in the works, and revisiting some older characters too. Like I think Kate Mulgrew as Catherine Janeway is going to get her own series at some point. So I think we're really starting to, I think we really have to kind of redefine, or like they may be trying to redefine somewhat what is good Trek and what isn't good Trek at this point, because we're seeing so many avenues now where you can see a different side of it, see it go in a different direction as far as plot goes, as far as themes go. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how much of the old is kept in the visual presentation, in the plot line, in the flow of it, versus going in different directions. So I think Lower Decks is going to be a part of that, but it's going to be part of a much bigger whole with how much content we have now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how do you feel as like a, you know, as someone who like grew up with Star Trek of a certain flavor, you know, like it ostensibly like getting darker and more adult, and also like, I guess, you know, like, again, like, yeah, I guess, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's it changes, and I think the thing that a lot of hardcore fans who are kind of like myself, who are kind of, you know, nostalgic for the past and different, or some would say better times, even though it may not be the case, because when you think about it, the original series was made in the late 60s, from 66 through 68. It reflected the attitude of the times, the social upheaval that was going on, the racism and the change in that was going on at the time, and the hippie movement. Then you get the fast forward to Star Trek, which is late 80s, early 90s. They were just coming out of an economic boom. Things are looking really good, but we're starting to see some societal issues crop up. Like they did an episode devoted to like homosexuality and, you know, the right of people to exist, the idea of justice and capital punishment, the idea of I'm trying to think of what else,
corruption, I guess, was
governmental corruption, and I think that, and I think the now what we're seeing more of is in this day and age in the skeptical at best, completely distrustful at worst of our leadership around the world, more or less. Mm-hmm. We've become more divided as far as our ideology is concerned, because we, through people with varying ideas now have a platform for really anything now. And I think it's more the fact that we're trying to make sense of it because it's growing so rapidly is part of what Star Trek is covering now, because and the overall tone of Star Trek has become more dark, because, you know, I don't want to say we're in a dark time right now. I mean, that's debatable, but we're trying to figure out, we feel that it is, because we don't know, we don't have a straight kind of set path to the future anymore, like we thought we did, back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's reflected in the tone of really a lot of mass media that we see, and Star Trek is kind of following that suit.
Well, that's interesting, because for me, that's kind of what the original series is about. Like, it was made as a kind of I probably wouldn't go that far. I would say almost it's like, you know, for me this year, TNG in particular has been like a bomb of like optimism, and that doesn't mean to say that obviously like that no one ever dies or nothing upsetting ever happens, but overall its message is of optimism.
Yeah,
like I've been talking everyone's ear off at the moment about how much I think that First Contact is such a perfect movie for TNG, because it ends on such a hopeful note. Mm-hmm. and it's not like, and the whole thing is that, oh my God, I always forget the name of the guy, played
By James Crow, Zefram Cochrane.
Thank you. I knew you'd have that, Mike. how Zefram is a screw up, and he's depicted as like this imperfect human, like fallible.
And alcoholic, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's basically what Star Trek for me is about. Like, especially TNG, like, no one on board is perfect. Right. And that's kind of the point, is that you can still survive and you can still be on this crew and be a valuable member of the crew and not be a perfect person, but work on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
that streak for me is really there in Lower Decks of like,
yes,
you can be a screw up, but you belong here.
Yeah. We still respect you for what you are and like you for what you are. And yeah, I hope that's what a lot of the other series will ultimately go towards, because I think the focus has been a bit more on the dark and gritty storylines, the kind of really deep dive into the soul of the characters. But I think what Trek is trying to do, or what I hope they try to do now, is keep that optimism but kind of funnel it into a modern, because as a society, we're a lot more cynical than we were in the 80s, it seems. So if they can portray that exact message that you're talking about through a more modern kind of cynical perspective, I guess that, I mean, as much sense as that makes, it's like, we don't trust our leadership anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The world is not as optimistic and not as friendly as it used to be, but you know, we can still have this optimistic vision. We can still, it's not just a pipe dream. We can still get by and make it happen as best we can. It may not be what the end result may not be what we were hoping for at first, but it will be good.
Mm-hmm. As long as we go into it with, you know, that kind of optimistic mindset.
Yeah, exactly.
Or keep that belief alive.
Well said. Well, I think that's a great closing statement there.
I agree. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here. This was a very unique episode of the podcast today, but I'm really glad that we had the opportunity to watch this show, because it was, I remember when the promos first came out, I was very optimistic for it myself. So I'm glad that after we all had a chance to go and watch it, that seems to be the general theme of what we got from it. So awesome. So yes, I'll go ahead and thank all of our listeners for tuning into this episode. Hope you, if you haven't seen Star Trek Lower Decks, if you have a CBS All Access, that's where you'll be able to stream it. It's very good, very funny. Definitely, if you're a fan of Star Trek, would you consider this a must-see?
Yeah, I would. And for the reasons that we said just now, I think that's why it's a must-see.
Mm-hmm. And who knows, as Dan said earlier, you might get more out of it by rewatching a few episodes, and we'll look forward to seeing what's coming up for a second season. So we'd like to go around normally, since Mike, you're new here, we normally at this time we go around and we introduce, you know, say what, if we want to follow us on social media, where we would go and look for, you know, if any of our listeners wants to follow what we're up to. Dan, can we start with you as always?
Yeah, you can find all my bad tweets at Hamu on Twitter.
Okay. And you can find me, I'm on both Instagram and Twitter as well, though I mainly use Instagram at Fail2Ninja. Michael, is there anything you would care to plug?
Not at the moment, but there will be. I am in the amateur fiction field right now, and that's most of what I've posted is on is Blue Streak, BLUSTRK 10 at deviantart.com.
Mm-hmm.
There's more content to come as I have the time to create it, but check it out. I'm looking to build up some Star Trek lore, explore some different ideas as well, so check it out.
All right, very good. Well, everyone, thank you once again for tuning in to this episode of the AFA podcast, and we'll see you in the next one. Take care.
Live long and prosper.
Ah.
Across the universe
on the Starship Enterprise under Captain Kirk.
Star trekking across the universe,
slowly going forward 'cause we can't find reverse.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow, starboard bow. There's Klingons on the starboard bow, starboard bow. Yeah.
When someone first comes in and you see that discouragement on their face, they've tried so many different products, but nothing seemed to work for them, I'm able to take that disappointment and that pain and turn it into hope.
You're listening to Mallory, an art support specialist at the Goodfeet store.
And they try the art supports. It's a light up moment. You see their face brighten up. They go from feeling discouraged to being happy and hopeful again.
For over 25 years, the Goodfeet store and our art support specialist have been helping folks live the life they love without foot, knee, hip, or back pain getting in the way.
That's why this job is so important. You're helping people, getting back into the activities that they've wanted to do for a long time, doing the things that they love to do with their Goodfeet Arch supports. We're able to help them and take them from the pain to the possibilities. And I love it.
The Goodfeet store is located in Fairfax, Leesburg, Rockville, Baltimore and Hunt Valley, and in Annapolis in the Annapolis Harbor Center. For more information, go to goodfeet.com.
So much to explore at Total Wine and More. Pinot Noirs, Grigios, Champagnes, and Chardonnays. Plus more than 2,500 beers and bourbon barrel aged. Tequila, rum, scotch, and gin, vermouth that's extra dry. Hard seltzers and single malts, so many for you to try.
Now offering delivery in select markets. See details at TotalWine.com/delivery. Drink responsibly, B21.